Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how does social media influence political campaigns and communication in contemporary America? And first, what's so important about the vice presidency, and what are the implications of Kamala Harris, the first woman of color on a major party ticket? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Joe Biden, the presumed Democratic nominee for president of the United States, has chosen Senator Kamala Harris of California to run with him on the national ticket as vice president. Harris is the first woman of color to run on a major party national ticket in the United States. On today's show, we will explore the impact of a vice presidential candidate on the success of the national ticket. We will explore the impact of this choice on Joe Biden's chances to win the 2020 election. And we will broadly examine the role of the vice president, both electorally and within the governance of the presidency. Our guests today are Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. And Arthur Auerbach, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Southern California. He is the author of The Dividing Line on Capital Punishment. So Professor Suri, I'll start with you. This is a historic selection. How important is the history behind this selection?
I think the history behind this election is absolutely crucial in three ways. First, vice presidents are generally chosen to convey to the voting public, at least in the modern American political setting, someone who is ready to take over, to be a heartbeat away, we like to say. And so what you want to convey when you're choosing a vice president, if you're in Joe Biden's position, is someone who looks like they could be a president. And for Kamala Harris to be seen as presidential by as many people as she obviously is seen by, that's a remarkable accomplishment in American society. We've had an African-American male president, but we have not had an African-American female president. In fact, African-American women are one of the least represented groups in American society in many leadership positions. So this is an incredible step forward in that way. Second, it's a step forward because the Democratic Party has never had anyone at the top of the ticket from California. We've had presidents from California, but they've been on the Republican side, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. The traditional home of Democratic politics has been the Midwest and the Northeast, and with the one exception of Texas and Lyndon Johnson, it's pretty much been other regions of the country. This shows that the Democratic Party, with Kamala Harris, is now firmly situated in California. We kind of knew that already, but this really puts a stamp on that. We can expect to see more national candidates from California coming out of this. And then third and finally, I think what's very significant about Kamala Harris in this moment is that she is so much younger than the presidential candidate, and there's a very high likelihood that she will be an active participant in Joe Biden's administration if elected. And so we're looking at someone who's going to have policy influence. We can imagine that she'll have policy influence around race issues, around criminal justice issues, and around issues regarding foreign policy as well. So her policy positions matter a lot more than they have for other vice presidential candidates in the past.
And Professor Auerbach, how important has the vice president been in previous elections? It seems like it can hurt a candidate. Can it really help a candidate?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. You know, the vice presidency selection does tend to be one that you're certainly not going to win based on who you pick, but you absolutely could lose if you just look at McCain-Palin as a perfect example. That was such a selection that came out of left field, and I think people really started to associate that particular vice president selection with a lack of judgment. And if you're going to have that lack of judgment at that level, my goodness, what might come down the road? So, I think that Joe Biden, personally was looking for a partner, for someone that he could really work with, much like he worked with Barack Obama when Obama was president. And so, at least up front, face value, it looks like he's probably picked somebody that that he can work with and has a breadth of experience. So it looks like he's off to a good start.
So Professor Suri, it seems like if there was one constituency that Joe Biden could count on voting for him, it was Black women. So the fact that he's chosen a Black woman as his running mate seems to reinforce this constituency that really was already in his, in his corner. Was that a bit of a mistake in that he's reaching out to people who he already had their vote?
So I think historically there have been two philosophies on choosing a vice president with any electoral hopes attached to that, because as Art said, quite often vice presidents can only hurt you, not help you. But if you're trying to get an electoral boost by one you choose, you either choose someone who reaches out to a community you have not been able to reach out to. I think this is what John McCain was trying to do with Sarah Palin, reaching out to the far right of the party. Or you choose someone who is actually in the heart of your base of support to assure that your supporters come out for you. And I think that's the position that Joe Biden has taken. And I would argue historically, that's generally what's worked best. Few people are convinced, as Art already implied, I can think of only one case, 1960 with Lyndon Johnson, where you can point to a constituency that might have come out to vote for a candidate for John F. Kennedy because of a particular person on the vice presidential slot. What you have more often are people who are already enthusiastic, for whom you want to reinforce that enthusiasm and make sure they don't forget to come out and make sure they remind every single person in that constituency to vote for you. Part of Joe Biden's strategy is to make sure that he really maximizes the minority vote. He's running against a president who he perceives and will argue is hostile to minorities. And so every minority vote, particularly in states like Texas that have traditionally been Republican states that now look like they might flip, he's hoping that someone like Kamala Harris will inspire more of those voters who already don't like Trump to now come out and vote for him. So it was probably a wise choice in that sense. It's hard to imagine the alternative working, where if he chose someone who was far removed and far different from himself, it's hard to imagine that that would actually win people over.
This had to have been one of the least surprising vice presidential choices. I know most of us had speculated, even at the time when she was running, she was asked about whether she was going to be on the ticket. It seems to signal something about the Biden campaign, which is no surprises here. He's been playing very safe, and this selection seems to be a fairly safe selection. First, do you agree? And second, what does that mean about the campaign?
I certainly agree. I think what it tells you about Joe Biden now and historically is that he's a very politically savvy politician. He was not about to stick his neck out and make a selection that could in any way frame him for what he really is, which is a centrist. And I think that he certainly could have gone down the road of taking someone more progressive to placate the Bernieites out there. He chose not to. And I think he chose not to because that's not who Joe Biden is. Like it or not, that's not who he is. He is a left-leaning moderate, and I think he was looking for a left-leaning partner, and he got it with Kamala Harris. There were other choices available, you know, if he was looking for, obviously he was looking for a female, he set that out early. If he was talking about a person of color, there were other well-qualified female women of color, from Florida, from Georgia, from other states that, you know, could come into play when you're talking about the election in November. But I think what he did personally is he just dug down deep and said, who can I really work with and who's going to be on the same page with me so we can move this country forward? So some people aren't happy with that. Some people just think he should have gone more left. But at the end of the day, you know, the candidates move out to the extremes in the primary and they move back to the middle on the general. And that's exactly what Joe Biden did.
Yeah, Jeremy, as a response.
I agree 100%. I just wanted to emphasize that even though this might have been the obvious choice, it was still a courageous choice. And I'm not saying that because of Kamala Harris's politics per se. I'm saying that because of who she is. There's always that variable. as to what people will do when they actually vote. And what Donald Trump proved in 2016 is there's still a lot of racism out there. Joe Biden believes those are not his voters. But nonetheless, we don't know for certain. And there are constituencies in Wisconsin and Michigan and elsewhere that voted in one election for Barack Obama and then in another election for Donald Trump. So we really don't know where they stand on this. So it was a courageous issue, a courageous decision on Joe Biden's part. I think if he were risk averse, really risk averse, he might have gone with Gretchen Whitmer, who's
governor of Michigan, right? That's exactly right.
So part of it, I think Art and I are agreeing, part of it was, you know, choosing someone who had obvious national stature, who had been vetted, who had proven that she could be a good partner. But part of it was also recognizing that it was time to take this leap, to go into this new space and put an African-American woman or an Indian, Jamaican-American woman on the ticket, to put immigration front and center, to put birtherism out there again. We've seen that already, this false claim about her not being a citizen, to subject oneself to that for the purposes of, I think, serving a larger political agenda that Joe Biden represents.
Now, Jeremy made this reference. I want to ask you, Art, as well. One of the things that was striking about the primary process in the Democratic Party was that although it started off extremely diverse and intergenerational, it ended with two old white guys. And so it's odd for me to think, as Kamala Harris is 55 years old, that she's the young candidate, you know, out there. But in any case, that there's this need for the Democratic Party that over the course of the last few elections seems to have aged with its national candidates pretty dramatically, despite the fact that the people who are getting the headlines, you know, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, are actually quite young, but the national ticket start to reflect what is clearly becoming an intergenerational differences between the two political parties.
I think it's a moment in time. And what I mean by that is I think we're at a time where it's sort of feast and famine. We don't have a lot of, you know, we have people on the ends. We've got, you know, the older folks. You've got a bunch of, you know, young aspiring Dems and Republicans for that matter that are coming up. But there aren't a lot of sort of that mid-range. And I think that's where we're at. You know, politics is very cyclical. I think that, you know, 4 years from now, the field might look, you know, distinctly different. The other thing I would suggest is that I think the Democratic machine, for lack of a better word, was not going to be really comfortable with sort of sticking their neck out with someone who was young, like, you know, I mean, pick your favorite one. But I think that they just wanted to go with the tried and the true. And that's Joe Biden. Is he old? Absolutely. I mean, look, every candidate has warts. Kamala Harris has issues that she's going to have to battle through being, you know, when she was a DA, when she was a state AG, even as a U.S. senator, you know, and no politician gets to this level without having blemishes along the way. But I think she'll probably be able to fight through those pretty well. I mean, even just reading through, you know, the newspapers over the last, you know, since the nomination, there hasn't been this blistering, oh my gosh, I can't believe Joe Biden selected Kamala Harris. There's been, you know, nits, but that's pretty small stuff, all things considered.
Hey, Jeremy.
I just wanted to follow up on that and say that there is a really interesting historical point here too, which is that the institutions of our parties no longer represent the people in their parties. And that's actually true on both sides. It's worse for the Republican Party. And I'm not saying that for ideological reasons. I'm saying that because you see in all surveys how the elected leadership is way out of the mainstream on issues of like economic issues, on the coronavirus, from where mainstream Republican voters are. It's true to some extent within the Democratic Party. We have party machinery and we have a machinery of government that's built around raising money and built around seniority in ways that crowd out younger voices. We're seeing more and more young people get elected to office in Congress and particularly at the state level. The largest county in Texas, one of the largest counties in the United States, Harris County, has a 36-year-old Hispanic woman who's the county leader, basically. So this is representative of how our society is changing. It's becoming more diverse and younger in its representation at the local level and in congressional races, but not in Senate races and not in presidential races. And that's something we need to think deeply about. I hope that's something actually that Kamala Harris herself will talk about. She has an argument to make that she had a disproportionately difficult road ahead of her during the primaries because they start out in New Hampshire and Iowa. And she's running as a candidate from California, from a diverse background. The deck was stacked against her from the start.
Absolutely. Now, Art, one of the highest profile moments in the debates was when Kamala Harris challenged Joe Biden in his position on busing and segregation. There's been a lot of conversation about, you know, what does this mean? Is this going to play a role, this, you know, this rift at all in the general election? And if so, what would be the best way to try to build a bridge to try to make that more of a positive rather than necessarily a negative for the Democratic ticket?
I personally have never seen that as a negative. Kamala Harris was trying to get the nomination. You know, you don't get the nomination by being the nice guy or a nice woman, as the case may be. You know, Kamala is a competitor. Joe's a competitor. They were all up there. And they weren't up there, just the two of them. They were up there with, I don't know how many different candidates. I mean, it was like 12 people and three different days. And they, I mean, you had to distinguish yourself. And the only way you can really do that, I think, is to dig in where there's a wedge opportunity to sort of separate yourself out from the front runner. And if, and it was, look, it was an inroad. Some people called it, you know, sort of a cheap shot. And I never saw it as that. I thought that she was trying to demonstrate, you know, her differences against Joe. Does that become a liability in the long run? No, I don't think so. I mean, it's a primary, you know, if it was a problem, Joe wouldn't have brought her on. It's that simple. I think if anything, I'm sure Joe was hurt initially. As anyone would be, because I think we're all sort of stunned when we were listening to that conversation. But no, I think you get over that. If your skin is that thin, then don't get into politics to begin with. I don't see that as being a problem. I really don't.
And Jeremy, I can sort of follow this up with you, but the nature of the comments on segregation and on race in America, et cetera, I think it's fair to say that after the killing of George Floyd and the protests, those issues have been transform. My own suggestion is for Biden to suggest that he learned from the comments and his position has evolved like most Americans have. I guess, first of all, am I off base? And secondly, does the Black Lives Matter protests and what's been going on throughout the summer change that context?
Absolutely. This is, again, why these are such dynamic situations. We can study candidates and we can, you know, add up vote totals and things like that, but they're all about the context that they're in. And someone who's a great candidate in one moment is not a great candidate in another. Joe Biden has had to, in some sense, reinvent himself. He's trusted. He's well-liked. He's seen as competent. And I think in this election, competence is cool, right? Because it's in such short supply. So those are attractive features he has. But he does have to deal with the burden of being someone who has long had a questionable record on civil rights. People remember, I remember, I was in college. I was at Stanford when we had the Anita Hill hearings. And Clarence Thomas's confirmation. And Joe Biden was not a friend of Anita Hill's. He was a supporter of Clarence Thomas's in the end. And whether that was the right decision or not at that time, it doesn't age well for many of the Democratic voters, particularly in the progressive wing right now. So what Biden has to do, and what I think he started to do, Doug, is exactly what you said. He has to show that he has changed. Not necessarily admit mistake from the past, but say that was a different time. And now I'm living in a different time and I see this world differently. And that is why I think he made the claim he would choose a woman and then in the end chose a woman of minority background to show that he really cares about these issues and to treat her as a partner. What people are going to be noticing, what I've already heard my students and others saying, is not just that he chose her, the way he interacts with her. He interacts with her in a respectful way. He interacts with her in a way in which people who come from minority backgrounds can see respect shown. And I think that's what he's going to try to do. Joe Biden will never fully please Black Lives Matter progressive activists. And they have some very good points about blemishes in his record. but he's going to try to show that he's at least respectful, caring, and will reach out to them as much as they can expect from a candidate who's nationally viable. And he's going to argue, let's win this election. And even if I can't give you everything you want, I can give you more than anyone else would give you right now. And I think that's a pretty persuasive argument.
And oh, by the way, look at who I'm running against in his track record on race issues. I mean, you know, no one's perfect, and I'm sure Joe would be the first one to suggest he's not. But my goodness, you certainly could not put Joe Biden in the same camp as Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. No one would ever confuse those individuals.
Well, today Donald Trump said he's done more for African Americans than any other president.
So. Yeah, well, he's actually said quite a bit.
Yeah, of course, except for Lincoln. And so it's almost become axiomatic, it's become axiomatic to say the vice presidency has become considerably more important, from Gore becoming much more of a partner to, you know, Dick Cheney almost at times seemingly taking on the role of the president, or at least sort of like the COO of the White House, all the way down to with the president who takes so much of the spotlight. Donald Trump does give Mike Pence a role to play, a fairly substantial role to play with the coronavirus task force. With that in mind, we've always said we don't really care all that much about the vice presidency. The famous quote from John Garner that the vice presidency isn't worth a warm bucket of spit, I'll use the family friendly quote, does not seem to be the case any longer. So is this a more important decision than it has been in the past? And should we expect to see a continuing growing role of the vice presidency within the presidency itself?
Well, I think for at least this election, it certainly has to be. I mean, it's got to be on everyone's mind when you've got a nominee that's in their late 70s. And I don't want to sound ageist. I just want to sound pragmatic here. You know, Joe Biden will be in his early 80s, you know, if and when he finishes up that first term. Stranger things have happened than someone in their 80s passing away or having a major medical health event. So I think that's a piece of the puzzle, but I think your broader question is more interesting in the role of the presidency, you know, beginning on from Gore and on forward. I really think we have seen a more active role by vice presidents. I think with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, this will be no exception. Going forward, who knows? I think a lot of it has to do with the personality of the president. There are some presidents that really want to have, you know, Patsy sounds like the wrong word, and I'm sure it is, but someone with a lesser personality. It's almost like you want to make sure the bridesmaids aren't wearing the, you know, an outfit that makes the bride look bad. Well, it's sort of the same thing in a sense. So, you know, maybe this is a short term. I don't know. You know, Al Gore was what, 30 years ago, but maybe it's a trend, maybe it's not, but it's certainly in play this for this round.
Jeremy, sir, I'll give you the last word on that question. Should we expect to see an even more active, energetic, important vice presidency going into the future?
Yes. One of the points I made in my book, The Impossible Presidency, was that actually presidents, especially since Nixon, have found themselves so overwhelmed with things they have to do, with what we as scholars call the rise of the administrative state, a much larger executive agency with many more responsibilities, much more responsibility in the public eye, much more international responsibility. You need trusted surrogates. And one of the reasons presidents, Democrats, and Republicans have made more use of the vice president is for that purpose. The president feels the vice president is a loyal soldier because the vice president wants the president to support her or his running thereafter. So this is a loyal soldier you can send out, someone who also has some credibility with members of Congress, especially as in this case, as with Pence, as with Biden, someone who's come from the Senate, and someone who usually is pretty politically savvy. And so this is a tool you want to deploy. If a future president, Biden or someone else, doesn't use the vice president this way, he or she will have to find someone else instead.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, for your thoughts on this historic development with the selection of Kamala Harris as Joe Biden's running mate, the first woman of color on a major party national ticket. Our guests today have been Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs. And he's the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's highest office. And Arthur Auerbach, associate professor of political science at the University of Southern California, is the author of The Dividing Line on Capital Punishment. Thank you both.
When we come back, how social media is influencing presidential campaigns, complicating discourse, and possibly democratizing disaster reporting. Stay with us. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How does social media influence political campaigns and communication, complicating discourse, and possibly democratizing disaster reporting? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Social media has become a key feature of politics and communication in the United States. It will likely play a key role in the 2020 election, and the medium is always changing. The Trump administration has threatened sanctions against social media sites TikTok and WeChat, which may have an important effect on this election. On today's show, we will examine the role of social media in politics, the American threats against TikTok and WeChat, and how our political discourse is influenced by social media. Our guests are Jennifer Peterson, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communication. She is the author of Murder, the Media, and the Politics of Public Feelings, Remembering Matthew Shepard and James Byrd, Jr. Glenn Richardson, Jr. is professor of political science and public administration at Kutztown University. He is the editor of Social Media and Politics, A New Way to Participate in the Political Process. Professor Peterson, we'll start with you. What exactly do we mean by social media, and how does that influence the way in which people generally communicate publicly?
Social media is very different from what we talk about as legacy media, newspapers, and broadcast, in that social media is peer-to-peer. There isn't a publisher that is centralized or broadcaster that is, you know, in one place that is a professional sending out communications to a broad audience, but rather members, people who formerly were audience members are now people who are creating communication, who are publishers, who are speakers. And so that's very different in terms of what it means. Like, everybody's communicated, everybody has the printing press and is engaged in this, the process of public speech, political speech. It blurs public and private a little bit. Some of the things that go on in social media are more like what would have been like a letter or a note you pass to your friend or a postcard. Some of them are more like an editorial in the newspaper. So there's kind of a blurring of what were tradition, you know, for most of the 20th century at least, very different modes of communication, public, political communication, and private, intimate communication. And that gets really blurred. And of course, third, they're just new, and which means we're still figuring it out. Figuring out norms, figuring out regulation and trust and how we assess truth in these formats.
Professor Richardson, social media clearly has had an impact on American politics, and there's been a lot of conversations about its role, certainly in the 2016 election, but prior to that. Generally speaking, though, how transformative is social media when thinking about political processes and the politics in the United States?
It's highly transformative. It's changed campaigns, agenda setting, most aspects of political communication. You have, and I'll add to that, it's changed the nature of leadership. And we think about campaigns, leadership, agenda setting, you know, you're talking about core elements of political communication. As Dr. Peterson pointed out, now ordinary citizens are able to put their messages out there and they can reach incredible audiences by being shared by other social media users. It's changed campaigns, obviously, in multiple ways. I think actually there's more change to come. I think most campaigns still to this day view social media through the lens of broadcast. And so their social media postings and content aren't as interactive with the users as they might be. But if you look at candidates from AOC to Donald Trump, you don't have to look far to see a profound impact on campaigning. And this, you know, bleeds over into leadership as well. Again, I think some, like AOC, do a better job of engaging with their constituents. And I'm currently engaged in a little research project looking at the members of Congress and their Twitter networks. And it really varies. And most of them still have relatively small inactive networks, but a few members really do stand out.
One way in which it certainly has had this impact on political communication has been the impact specifically of Twitter and its character limitations, and something that we've been talking about for years, the way in which politics has become really about sound bites and the ability to try to synopsize, in some cases, fairly complex positions in 140 or, I suppose, at times 280 characters. How much has that transformed, just messaging in general? I'll ask that Professor Richardson first and then to Professor Peterson.
For the sake of discussion, I'll say it's been, more evolutionary than revolutionary. There were studies out there on sound bites on network news, and they got smaller. And this was even before, the rise of Twitter. But slogans are nothing new to American politics. And, to be fair, you can serial tweet. So if you have something that takes more than 280 characters, then you can run a couple of tweets in a row. Also, for better or for worse, and both Professor Peterson and I can appreciate this, I'll speak for myself. We have a generation of students who openly speak of their lessened attention spans. And so, as they scroll through their various feeds, this is something that can engage them in a way that other content wouldn't. So that's sort of the upside. I think that you do raise an important question. I think it's an enduring question of democracy, which is how you link citizens and, their level of knowledge and engagement of politics with government through elected officials and campaign process. And I think that's a complicated process. And I think, a lot of political scientists or historians tend to have very high regard for political leaders like Lincoln or FDR, who are able to communicate very effectively. I think, for better and worse, Donald Trump is very effective at communicating, the message he wants to communicate to the people he wants to communicate. And they, I think, respond precisely because he says it like they think it, like they feel it. That's raises all kinds of other issues, given, the kind of divisive politics that's resulted from, just focusing so much on that base of supporters.
Professor Peterson, actually, to change it slightly, I know you've been doing a lot of work on the way in which public sort of emotive social interactions and emotive politics, played a role. This is something that's always fascinated me in my research, is kind of, emotional politics. But has social media heightened this emotional element that we have in our communication, and in particular social and political communication?
I actually think that emotion is harder to convey, like in the short tweet format, but there's a lot of discussion of emotionality in social media, which has less to do with the actual formats of, say, a tweet or a Facebook post, and more to do with the business decisions about how to structure the websites, how to present your feed to you in order to bolster engagement, and going for things that seem likely to evoke certain emotional responses are very good ways to get engagement. So there's a very good business decision there, but it has less to do with, say, the format thing, I think.
And sort of another theme, certainly, and Professor Richardson highlighted this partially, has been this democratization of communication. One of the things about social media is anybody can have a Twitter, and anybody can have a Facebook account or a TikTok or whatever. Although certainly it has somewhat democratized, but not everybody's Twitter is treated equally. And being able to develop networks of followers, and we have this new term that we've all had to come to grips with called an influencer. That's had this impact on our politics and on society. So first of all, Professor Peterson, is this democratization, and is it real? Does social media really give a lot more people access? And what does that mean with respect to messaging in politics and society?
And I do think the democratization is real. Yes, many people, many, many more people have the ability to speak. And, the recent protests over the killing of George Floyd and so many other people, I don't think these would have happened. And Black Lives Matter probably would not have happened with the traditional media gatekeeping in place, the ability of people to reach out and convey these eyewitness accounts, which are, I think, going back to the point on emotion, this is another way in which social media is a more emotional format, in the sense that individuals can give eyewitness testimony that doesn't have to go through the kind of professionalism of traditional media. It doesn't have to be presented in a balanced manner or made more palatable in some way, like you need to do or people feel they need to do on the news. So you have people presenting very immediate, very horrific, emotional things, and you're watching them and feeling them and feeling that rawness. So in that way, that's very, very different emotional tenor, and I think is very different politically.
But Glenn Richardson, one of the challenges has always been there's no editor online. And certainly when thinking about the 2016 election and the impact of this lack of an editor, which has given us this phrase, carries its own emotion, fake news, or at least false reporting. How much of a concern should we have about this lack of an editor?
I think it's a cause of great concern. I mean, and you've seen all kinds of fake news turn into real consequences, from Pizzagate to almost any political issue. I think this is Professor Peterson's area of expertise. The law here is really important, and as you noted, there's no editor, but there is a publisher, if you will, who's choosing, often through algorithms, as she pointed out, designed to engage users and keep them on platform, what is coming out there. And I believe it is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act that gives social media companies protection that wouldn't apply if they were a newspaper, and for the harms or injuries that may result from content on their platform. I think the technology, deep fakes and misinformation, the willingness of all kinds of actors to use it, I think poses something close to an existential crisis for our democracy, because I'm just not sure how people, people already just say, I don't know what to trust. You can't trust it. It's hard to get out of that box.
Now, from a legal perspective, one of the things that frustrates me is when people say, well, there's no way to regulate what's going on social media, though Congress actually has. In one very, very important piece of legislation, the so-called FOSTA-SESTA legislation, where if a crime is committed as a result of a posting, it could open up liability against the website that has posted it. The specific issue was sexual violence, and the websites Craigslist and Backpage had found themselves potentially politically liable. Is the fact that there isn't as much regulation because of the difficulty of trying to create legislation as it's typically been produced, or is it just a lack of political will? I'll ask that first of Professor Peterson.
So I think it's always possible to create regulation. It's possible to create bad regulation. It's possible to create good regulation. Often when we say we can't, I don't think that holds a lot of water, because as you point out, it is always possible, and it is always already regulated in some form. But I wanted to add on to a couple of things that Professor Richardson said, if that's okay. And while I share his deep, deep, deep concern about what's going on right now, the one place that makes me maybe step back or gives me maybe a little distance from that is thinking historically. And what's going on right now is unique, and it's very different from what was going on, say, in the 1930s when radio was new. But at the same time, when radio was new, it seemed much more immediate. It seemed more authentic to people. There were a number of kind of political entrepreneurs who were making use of radio for a combination of political messaging and private profit. Reverend Bob Schuller, Father Coughlin were among those people. And audiences were at first quite easily or had a very hard time negotiating when should we trust this kind of information we're getting over the radio, and when is it misinformation? When is it somebody who is actually just trying to collect money from an audience? And it was very difficult initially, and a lot of people did end up being taken advantage of by these early kind of entrepreneurs, and there was a lot of political use and abuse of the radio. But it took people a little while, and they began to figure out new techniques and new practices of establishing trust, of listening, where they began to be better at discerning misinformation. I don't know if we'll be able to do that because, you know, what we're seeing is amplified. It's more than in the 1920s and 1930s, but it is always very difficult when there is a new medium and at play and new types of misinformation or new ways of putting out misinformation. Oh, and I also was going to note one thing about the issues around social media and companies like Facebook. There's a really important point that Professor Richardson brought up about publishers. And in terms of law and regulation and free speech, this is hugely important whether or not Facebook is a publisher or merely a carrier of people's speech. And these companies go back and forth on this. And one of the reasons is around one of them is around liability, as you guys brought up, but the other one is around how the First Amendment is going to apply. So if Facebook says we're a publisher, that means they get a huge amount of First Amendment protection, like a newspaper. And it means that the owner is the only relevant speaker there, right? So the person who gets to make the decision about what happens and what gets said, what doesn't get said, is the editor, or in Facebook's case, I guess, Mark Zuckerberg. Whereas if they are merely a conduit, which is what they're suggesting when they go to Section 230, they're not speakers at all. They are passive conduits, and they're very agnostic about what people say on their platform, and they don't have very much legal liability about what happens. And so right now these platforms are kind of often having it both ways. In one moment they're saying, oh, we're like a newspaper. In another moment saying, oh, no, we're not. We're kind of more like the telephone company or a telegraph or, you know, just a carrier. And which is interesting. And there's some truth in the fact that they're not like existing companies. They're a little bit neither fish nor fowl, but it contributes to regulatory difficulty that you're bringing.
Absolutely. You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today we are exploring the role that social media plays in American politics. Now, shifting gears a little bit, Professor Richardson, one of the areas that social media definitely seems to be perhaps revolutionary, certainly at least evolutionary, is the international quality of the platforms. It's giving external actors from the United States an entry point into American politics. And though it's certainly not the first time international actors have been interested and tried to influence American politics, it certainly seems to be amplified. Is it fair to say that this is really a substantially different type of interference. And what does that mean for the 2020 election and beyond?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think you framed it well. Now, I forget which PBS historical video I was watching that mentioned Russian interference in the like World War I era elections. And I couldn't help but, you know, thinking about today. So you're right. I mean, it has happened. And you used the word amplified. And I think Professor Peterson used that word as well. And it may be a better word. The word I've been kind of struggling with is scale, which is somehow I'm trying to grasp at. There are things that are okay. You know, it occurred to me with say micro-targeting. It's okay, you know, we can live with people targeting one message to one group and one message to another group. But when you can scale down to, you know, such micro-level information and do it at scale to almost everybody with different messages. And I think the same applies here. You know, now that the scale of potential meddling is immense. And so, again, that's part of my concern about this existential crisis, in part because it really is based on, you know, the living, breathing fabric of our democracy. You know, all you need to do is put a message in the stream, in the flow, and you know, then organically, you know, it kind of becomes part of the conversation. I did some research on 2016, and the Russian bots didn't get a lot of reach. They tweeted at each other. They were a small percentage of the total tweets about the election. But by the same token, there clearly were some well-documented cases where, you know, they had fabricated events and real Americans showed up. And you've seen it already this cycle as well, with heightening anxieties or animosities on different questions. So you have a great capacity to do something that's kind of easy to do, which is divide Americans. And I find it troubling, and I'm trying to find a, you know, hopeful way to confront that.
And certainly the recent news of the administration proposing sanctions, not exactly sure what these sanctions would mean, but some sort of action against, you know, the Chinese-owned company TikTok. How much of that is this desire to limit an international presence in the social media climate, or how much of it is, you know, based on, you know, broader issues about trade? Or I've certainly heard it suggested that this is just a move to try to force TikTok to sell to an American company like Microsoft. What's the best way, Professor Peterson, to think about these moves of the administration against TikTok and WeChat?
So, like, in terms of international relations, I would defer to the international relations experts. But there is a long history of the U.S. being worried about foreign influence through media. And we have historically limited foreign ownership of media. So, for example, Section 310 of the Communications Act of 1934 has big limits on how much, what percentage of ownership can of a media outlet, you know, a broadcasting media outlet can be owned by a foreign entity or individual because of concerns about foreign individuals or governments influencing public opinion, morale, and these came out of, you know, World War I, the post-World War I era. And of course, in the 1930s, the lead up to World War II, there was a very big concern around foreign radio stations at the time influencing US public opinion. And so, for example, Rupert Murdoch had to give up his Australian citizenship in order to buy the media outlets that would become Fox Broadcasting. And, you know, and also similarly, there were problems with ownership of Univision and Univision getting a license in the United States. This is different, a little bit different though, because in those cases, again, we're worried about influence. And this is a history of worrying about influence, which is usually about the content. And at this point with TikTok, the stated concern, whether or not this is the actual motivating concern, is about collection of data from users. So that's a big difference. And so the type of influence and the type of security threat that, that is being referenced is different from in the past.
Professor Richardson, is this move against TikTok potentially a signal? I know there's been quite a bit of political signaling that the U.S. government would like to try to control some of these social media platforms. The best way to think about this move against TikTok, that this is the government flexing its muscles to try to control social media, or is it really much more about trade or, you know, some other issue that really doesn't fit in the same conceptual box as, say, the government's relationship with Facebook or Twitter or something?
That's a great question. You know, if you read some of the news accounts of the internal debate in the administration, you had Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, Peter Navarro, the trade rep, you know, verbally and heatedly disagreeing on this decision. I'm reticent to speculate about, you know, President Trump's internal thinking, but there are multiple plausible explanations and not necessarily consistent. It's just tough to untangle all of that. I will not rule out the possibility of a certain genius to it all, you know, chipping away, you know, with the national security claim against, you know, a Chinese company. You know, that's a low bar, in, at least in terms of public opinion. And does it, you know, open the door for more attempts to influence or intimidate the U.S.-owned companies? You know, my sense of corporate, you know, thinking and behaviors, it would be on their radar. You know, and oftentimes that so-called chilling effect can be more effective than an overt intimidation. So, you know, yeah, that is a possibility. And I can't claim, you know, any particular insight to sort of parse out, other than to say, you know, given what we know, Navarro prevailing, Navarro's the trade rep, you know, he's been a prominent, I guess, nationalist is one of the terms they would use, that seems to be, you know, primary here. You know, whether it appealed to President Trump additionally because of the, you know, effect on American media companies, yeah, that could be a decisive factor among many.
Professor Peterson.
I just wanted to add to Professor Richardson there, noting that if this is an effort at intimidation, it's far more subtle than some of the other ones that have gone. And it's very plausible, but I would it's much more subtle than, say, his response to Twitter's, you know, flagging his comment, which was so clearly an attempt to try to steer the internal policies of Twitter, and even more than that, Facebook, trying to put pressure on these companies through, you know, tactics of putting them on the defensive and trying to prove that they're not politically biased. And that was very overt. And if this is that attempt to control, as Professor Richardson said, there's a certain genius to it, and it's very subtle.
and this is an administration that's not necessarily been known for its subtlety.
Well stated.
So, Professor Richardson, what kind of impact do you think social media is going to play on this election? You mentioned about how the campaigns certainly, you know, have certainly changed, but there's a lot of transformation taking place that won't be completed by the end of 2020. But do you have any speculation about the kind of impact it may have?
Well, you know, I would almost start with a baseline. Social media is the most important, you know, field of political communication that's out there right now, with the caveat that a lot of the social media content amplifies the legacy media. People share reports from New York Times, the Washington Post, or Fox, or what have you. When you look at particularly younger Americans, social media is typically their principal, if not exclusive, source of information. The candidates spend billions of dollars. The campaigns spend billions of dollars. And, you know, for reasons that we have highlighted, there's a dynamism to it. You can have social media eruptions. Professor Peterson made a great point. You know, it's the combination of these things, the combination of video recording in everybody's smartphones and social media that allows things to erupt. I do feel compelled to note again, there's some evolutionary quality to it, you know, although this does approach revolutionary level. I'm reminded, you know, we just saw the nation mourn and memorialize John Lewis. And I think it was 60 years ago when the student sit-ins spread like wildfire down south, particularly in the historically black colleges and universities. And this was before social media. And yet it really did, you know, have some of the aspects we would recognize today as going viral. But, you know, that was a community that was well and tightly organized with particular media. And it's also the case that, you know, as the 60s wore on, Dr. King and his movement realized the importance of television and, you know, changed his strategy accordingly to generate more confrontations, frankly, because they were better TV and generated audience. So, you know, that plays into it as well. I think, again, the thing that disturbs me, and maybe it's my political biases, is the degree of polarized intensity that the platforms have amplified and done it for profit. I mean, people have their own tendency to group and so on and so forth. But I think in the context of social media, it has amplified that considerably.
And with that, I want to thank our guests on this discussion on the role that social media is playing in politics and society, certainly in the 2020 election and beyond. Our guests have been Jennifer Peterson, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communication. She is the author of Murder, the Media, and the Politics of Public Feelings, Remembering Matthew Shepard and James Byrd, Jr. Glenn Richardson, Jr., Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at Kutztown University. He is the editor of Social Media and Politics, A New Way to Participate in the Political Process. Thank you both very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.